You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And, it's like going to the dentist and hearing him say, oops, right? You know, or it's like, you don't want to hear that. Anyhow, the man who has stoked fear about imposters at the polls, we're going to be getting into that. Alec McGinnis is going to be here, senior editor with the New Republic, Dana Siegelman. Talking about her dad, Governor Don Siegelman, who we have been following from ground zero, from day one, when Karl Rove first went after him. In fact, arguably before that, back in 2002, when Bob Riley stole the election from him, rigging a voting machine, you know, suddenly finding 15,000 votes in a Republican precinct after all the Democratic poll watchers had left. And the votes they found were all on a machine, untraceable. And... well, there's a lot in the news, too, that we're going to be getting to as we continue through our day. But first, David Bender is with us. He's the political director of Progressive Voices, political activist, writer, and broadcaster. ProgressiveVoices.com is the website. The Twitter is at PROGVoices. And David, welcome back to the program.
Tom, it's always good to be back. And please give my regards to Dana Siegelman. We spent time at the convention with her father, who is now serving. He is a political prisoner.
Yeah.
And I've known Don Siegelman for over 30 years. He is a man of complete integrity, fundamental decency, and this is as great a miscarriage of justice as anything I've ever seen in the country.
Yeah, absolutely agreed. And in fact, every single day on this program, we ask people to we point out that Don Siegelman is America's newest political prisoner, and ask people to go to free-don.org and sign the petition asking President Obama to pardon him.
Absolutely.
So good. David,
good on you.
Here we are just 2 weeks out from the presidential elections, a day less now. Yep. And, I mean, the landscape, the voter suppression landscape is breathtaking what's going on. People getting phony letters down in Florida, the stuff going on in Ohio. Ellen Ratner on this program, you know, her family is from Ohio. Her cousin is running against Sherrod Brown. And she made a comment on the air here on the show a couple of days ago that what she's seen there is the ugliest she's ever seen. What's your sense of what's going on and how this election is shaping up?
First of all, I'm shocked that Ellen Ratner's cousin is Josh Mandel. So
yeah.
I need to recover from that for a moment.
It's by marriage.
He
married her cousin or something, or her sister. I don't know how it all works.
There's
but
no
anyhow.
Blood involved. That makes me feel a little bit better. But what my take is that there are rhythms in these elections, Tom, and I've been doing them, unfortunately, now since 1968. And there are so many similarities that come back to me as I look at how, you know, this campaign has played out. The one that first rings a bell is 1968, is Richard Nixon, because Mitt Romney is running Richard Nixon's successful, barely successful campaign against a non-incumbent, Hubert Humphrey. He ran as a reinvention, as if the old Nixon hadn't happened. Remember, they actually created, with the help of Roger Ailes, who was fresh off producing the Mike Douglas show.
And had made a proposal to Richard Nixon for what he called GOP TV.
Exactly right, which became Fox News later on. But Roger Ailes created a new Nixon. And the new Nixon was a nicer, friendlier, warmer guy who had no ideology at all, but he had a secret plan to end the war in Vietnam, which you would only get to find out if you voted for him. Now, does that sound at all familiar to what we're dealing with here? We have a guy who will create 12 million new jobs, so we don't tell you how until after the election. So that is one familiarity. Another, sadly, is 1980, where the threshold for Ronald Reagan was simply not tripping over his own shoelaces on the platform with Jimmy Carter. He was then judged in the one debate that they had to be able to serve as commander-in-chief. And that is the threshold that many in the mainstream media are saying that Mitt Romney crossed the other night, that he looked like he'd be a plausible commander-in-chief, even though he doesn't know that, you know, the route to the sea is not through Syria for Iran. But it wasn't the words, it was the demeanor. So those two things ring to me. But I'll tell you what I actually think the parallel is, and it is all in Ohio. This is 2004 in reverse. I actually think we are going to see a situation where President Obama carries Ohio and wins the election. Do I think it's safe 13 days out? I do not. The other thing that is different than our history and what you and I grew up with is we keep talking about election day, Tom, because that's how we've been raised. And there is one day where people go to the polls. But turns out now that it's election month. There can't be an October surprise because it would have had to have happened in September. This whole election, a third of the vote, maybe more than that, has already been cast in Iowa. A lot in Ohio. Early voting starts in Florida on Saturday. All these crucial states, voting is happening right now. And we can measure it, we can see it. And based on the metrics, based on the numbers that I'm seeing, it's going to be darn close. But I think if we keep our foot on the gas, and every day people work to get votes in that day in these states, President Obama will be reelected.
Yeah. Well, we shall see, David. I would not be at all surprised to see 2004 all over again, where there are all kinds of questions. I mean, you know, Ohio was lost by 60,000 votes, more or less. 186,000 ballots were never even opened. John Edwards really, really fought John Kerry. He wanted to contest that election. Wanted to point out that the votes weren't even counted in the state. They were counted by, or tabulated rather, counted, you know, and fed back to the Secretary of State by an out of state company that was doing all the secret email for Karl Rove. There's some really serious questions about what's going on in Ohio. And now the company that's doing that is in Virginia, and it's another Republican company.
And I know you don't mean, and none of us do, by reporting on this accurately and getting people to do the kind of work that you do and Greg Pallas does and others to talk about, Brad Friedman, and talk about, all of these horrible things that happen to dissuade people from the importance of their vote.
Well, this is the reason why the Democratic Party officially refuses to address the reality that our vote has been privatized, which is insane. I mean, of all the things that you're going to privatize, the vote should be the very last thing, because it's the mechanism by which everything else happens with regard to the commons. And whether there might be some, you think that these machines can't be manipulated, or that the tabulators or just dirty tricks can't be played? Talk to Don Siegelman.
Of course they can, but we have to see enough votes that it moves outside the margin of error.
Right, that's the thing. If they're going to steal 3 million, we need to show up with 5.
Exactly, and that's what has to happen in Ohio. I believe it can, and we're not telling anyone that their vote won't be counted. We're telling them that they have to get so many votes that there's no way they can steal
right.
this.
Right, and if possible, show up in person and make sure that your name is on the roll, and do not take a placebo ballot.
Absolutely.
Fight to make sure that you actually get a real ballot.
Absolutely right.
So anyway, you're optimistic. I'm pleased to hear that, David Bender.
I am cautiously optimistic, and it will remain so until Ohio is declared for President Obama, as was the case 4 years ago when Ohio was carried by the president. I happened to be broadcasting from Grant Park and watched as Fox had to, with their faces, their Roger Ailes faces, melting, say Obama carries Ohio.
Yeah.
I want to see it again.
It's going to be very interesting to watch. David Bender, the website progressivevoices.com for more information. David, always great to talk with you.
You too, Tom. All the best.
Thanks for dropping by. We'll be back 15 minutes past the hour. What is up? But this, we just went to jail?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
For outing the Bush torture program? I got to tell you about this after the break. Stick around.
Because we got him on the spot. Welcome back.
Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. Welcome
oh, yeah.
Back.
Thank
welcome
you. It's glad back. To be here. Back here in Washington, D.C. Just arrived about an hour and a half ago. And just in time to get to the studio. And the only person to be criminally prosecuted with regard to the Bush war crimes of torture was the whistleblower. Tell me, I mean, this is just like with UBS, the United Bank of Switzerland, I think is what UBS stands for. UBS, the big Swiss bank, was helping over 10,000. My recollection is it was either 14 or 17,000, but it was over 10,000 Americans hide money so that we couldn't tax it. Now we're talking millionaires and billionaires here. And there was an American who worked for UBS. He was living in Zurich. And, you know, he contacted the U.S. Department of Justice and said, you know, I'm a whistleblower. I've got information. Came back to the United States, gave that information to us. UBS negotiated a deal with us. They offered an amnesty to these people. I mean, there's a whole long sob story about it. Hey, we got to protect the billionaires, you know, but we do need to get them to pay their taxes, et cetera, et cetera. And then the guy who was the whistleblower went to jail because he violated the banking secrecy laws. Bizarre. So here, again, the guy, his name is John Kiriku, who revealed that the CIA was waterboarding people, that was torturing people, because in the process of revealing that information, and he gave it to the New York Times, he identified a CIA agent. He has been convicted. Yesterday, former CIA whistleblower John Kiriku pled guilty to revealing the identity of a CIA agent. He told the story of Al-Qaeda operative Abu Zubaydah, who was captured and waterboarded more than 80 times. He was originally charged under the Espionage Act. This was a plea deal to lesser charges, so he gets out of prison after only 2.5 years. Isn't that sweet? Jesselyn Raddick of the Government Accountability Project said, "The only person to be criminally prosecuted, now likely jailed as a result of the Bush-era torture regime, is John Kiriku." Now, you look at the other people who are involved in this, like John Yoo. What's he doing now? He's a professor in Berkeley, at Berkeley, the University of California, Berkeley. Or remember the name of the guy who's now a federal judge, the John Yoo's partner in crime, who was there? There was the two of them who wrote the letter that said this is not torture. And he's now sitting on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and, you know, in line to be on the Supreme Court. No. And so, you know, then, of course, Alberto Gonzalez and then Dick Cheney and George W. Bush. And none of these guys are going to jail. No. Instead, it's the guy who blew the whistle. This is just an unhealthy thing in a democracy. It's a deeply unhealthy thing. While I was in Chicago, when I was coming back out to the airport, my driver and I got into a bit of a political conversation. And what I think is interesting about this is that this is probably the way a lot of Americans think who don't have a lot of political information. You know, I made some comment about Romney's 24 lies in the last debate. And he's like, yeah, what are the lies? You know, so what? Everybody lies. All the politicians lie. Fact of the matter is the economy stinks. Let's get somebody else in. That was basically his perspective. It was more nuanced than that, and the conversation was a lot longer than that. But, you know, that was the essence of it. And I think that this is what has come out of this meeting that was in the caucus room restaurant on January 20th, 2009, the night that Barack Obama was sworn in as president of the United States. You had this group of people. My keeper list got moved around, so let me dig this thing out. Oh, geez, it's going to take some time. I'll just do it from memory. we'll see. Paul Ryan was there. John Kyle was there. Jeb Hensarling was there. In fact, Jeb Hensarling later said, "Oh, we're going to be like the Taliban." Newt Gingrich was there. He later said, "Tonight you saw the seeds of 2012 sown." In other words, this is how we're going to win the election of 2012. And they met at the caucus room restaurant, and they basically swore an oath to each other that anything that the Obama administration is going to do to try to save the economy, and keep in mind, at that time we were losing 700,000 jobs a month. Anything the Obama administration is going to do to try to stop that, they were going to fight. And for 2 months and one day, they didn't have the ability to do that because the Democrats held a majority, a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. for 2 months and 1 day, and they controlled the House of Representatives for 2 years. And Obama was able to get past his stimulus in that first 2 months, and it immediately stopped the hemorrhaging of jobs and got us back to the point where now we've had more than 35 months, something like that, of continuous job growth, over 4 million new jobs created. It ain't what it should be, but what it should be is not where it is, because he had 2 months and 2 months and 1 day where he controlled the Senate, you know, where the Republicans could not filibuster him. I saw Harry Reid in Nevada the weekend before last, and he made the comment that he will have served the same number of years as Lyndon Johnson as Senate Majority Leader, 6 years in November or December. And he's handled over 300, my recollection is 387 filibusters. Good legislation that the Democrats passed out of the House of Representatives during the 2 years that the Democrats controlled the House of Representatives. Good legislation that they then sent to the Senate. Things that would have, for example, changed our trade policies so that, you know, when Mitt Romney's Bain Capital wants to take apart a company like Sensata and ship all their equipment over to China, and make a tax deduction for, make a profit on it. This is an already profitable company, hundreds of millions of dollars in profit. That when they do that, they wouldn't get a tax break anymore. Goes to the Senate, it gets filibustered. It had more than 50 votes, gets filibustered. So these guys conspired, and their conspiracy worked. For all but 2 months and 1 day of the entire Obama presidency, they have been successful in blocking anything that would repair our economy. And now they're running on the fact that our economy sucks and people are buying it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And in part, frankly, people are buying it because President Obama didn't do what Harry Truman did and yell and scream about a do-nothing Congress or obstructionism throughout his presidency. He tried to work with them.
I'm leaving on a jet plane. Don't know when I'll be back.
No, I'm back. I am. I really am. Thanks to Mike Papantonio for filling in for me yesterday, by the way. It's a very special thanks and a happy birthday wish to him. Pap, we wish you the very best, you and Terry and all the people that you work with down there and everybody else. It's a pleasure and honor to know you and have you as a colleague. You need to know this. Last week, Paul Ryan attempted to show that he and Mitt Romney really do care about poor people in America. Remember, he showed up at the soup kitchen? Only problem, he arrived late, he didn't give any notice, he figured he'd do a photo op cleaning dishes, and the dishes were already clean. That stunt, which got a lot of negative political attention, has now nearly put that soup kitchen out of business. But Ryan still wants Americans to believe that he and Mitt Romney care about poverty. So much so that today in Ohio, he's given a speech on the issue. Right. Paul Ryan is worried about poor people. Mitt Romney's worried about poor people. Maybe Ryan could get away with talking a good game on poverty. Maybe he could convince America that he really does want to do something about the poor in America and declining social mobility. Except he's also the guy who wrote the Republican budget in the House of Representatives that completely decimates the poor in our nation. In that budget, 62% of Ryan's proposed spending cuts target programs that help low-income Americans. In that budget, the food stamp program, you know, Romney says, oh, food stamps are up. Well, yeah. Have you looked at what's happened since George Bush was president and crashed the economy? The food stamp program, which kept nearly 4 million Americans out of poverty in 2011, is completely gutted in Paul Ryan's budget, meaning no benefits or fewer benefits for millions of low-income Americans in the future. And mostly it's kids, by the way. In that budget, Medicaid, which provides health care for millions of low-income Americans, is slashed. According to the Urban Institute, it will result in Medicaid enrollment being cut in half. In the Romney-Ryan budget, Ryan cuts tax credits afforded to low-income Americans, like the Child Tax Credit and the Earned Income Tax Credit, that keep millions of Americans out of poverty. Ryan might have talked a good game today in Ohio, but we all know it's a charade. religious leaders all across the country are you kidding me? Basically is what they're saying. The largest national coalition of religious congregations, the PICO National Network, said of the Ryan budget, quote, "The mission of the church is to bring good news to the poor and to protect the vulnerable, not to justify the impoverishment of the very young, the very old, and the sick in order to enrich the wealthy," end quote. Which, by the way, is exactly what Paul Ryan's and Mitt Romney's budget does. The only thing we can expect Paul Ryan, what it does is it enriches the rich, is what I meant. The one thing that we can expect them to do is, you know, what they promised to do on paper. And that's to give massive tax cuts, $5 trillion worth of tax cuts to rich people like themselves and give austerity to the rest of us, which is only going to make wealth inequality in the United States worse and thus make it harder and harder for the poor to move into the middle class and reach for the American dream. Paul Ryan doesn't give a damn about the poor. He's just a shill for big business who wants to create an Ayn Rand utopia where the wealthy live like kings and the middle class and the poor live like feudal serfs. You know, don't buy that snake oil. Here's how it works. Here's the simple reality. The natural state of an economy is this, of a capitalist economy. Karl Marx identified this in Das Kapital back in the 19th century, and it's still a decent read, although his prescription, his diagnosis was absolutely accurate. His prescription turned out not to work so well, at least as it was tried by the Soviet Union. You could argue that it actually worked fairly well in Cuba. But in any case, setting all that aside, I don't want to sit here and defend communism. The point is that pure, unrestrained capitalism, laissez-faire capitalism, unregulated, leave-me-alone capitalism, it's essentially what laissez-faire means. The government doesn't interfere with business. Unregulated capitalism. What that always invariably leads to is the world that Charles Dickens wrote about when he wrote A Christmas Carol and virtually every other one of his books. His father had been in a debtor's prison. He knew from what he spoke. Where you've got a very, very small ruling class who typically don't even appear in Dickens' books. He didn't know the ruling class. You've got a small middle class, which Dickens ended up in. The middle class would be like Scrooge and Marley Incorporated, Scrooge Marley and Company, or Scrooge and Marley Company. Just, you know, a partnership, a two-person small business partnership with one employee, a bookkeeper, Bob Cratchit. And so you've got a very, very small middle class, which are that small group of people who have special skills, or there's no room for more of them. I mean, how many doctors do you need? How many lawyers do you need? How many butchers and candlestick makers and clothing stores do you need? At a certain point, there's no more room for any more. That becomes the middle class, the people who own those small businesses, the mercantilists. And then you've got a huge class of the working poor. That's the natural state of an economy. Let me say that again. This is so few Americans understand this. This is Econ 101. The natural state of an economy is to have a very tiny middle class. Because the middle class, people can only escape the ravages of the free labor market, the so-called free market in labor, by ring fencing themselves, by putting a fence around themselves and saying, okay, this, you know, there are limits on what we will do and what you must pay us or you don't get the work. Now, you can do that if you're a physician and there's a limited number of physicians and people need doctors. You can do that if you're a lawyer and there's a limited number of. You can't do that if you're an ordinary laborer. If you're any kind of job that somebody can basically step into with a high school or a simple college education, you can't do that. You can't demand a higher wage. And so what you end up with is the lowest wage. You end up competing with everybody else for the lowest wage. And wages simply drop, as we've seen ever since Reagan started taking apart the New Deal. Wages have been falling. Mitt Romney's campaigning on this. The middle class's wages have been falling. That's what happens when you have a deregulated economy. This is the consequence of 30 years of Reaganomics and the destruction of labor unions. What labor unions do, then the way they create a middle class, is the same way in Dickens' novels that the middle class was created by the mercantilists. There's only a limited number of people who need Scrooge and Marley's services. Now, it's been 30 years since I read A Christmas Carol to my kids. And by the way, reading the original is a real job. It's very dense, as I discovered when I tried to do it one Christmas. And I frankly don't remember what Scrooge and Marley did. I'm not sure it was ever articulated in the book. My guess is they were lawyers or, you know, provided some kind of service like that. Maybe architects. I don't know. I mean, their only employee was a bookkeeper, so they had some skill that that other people didn't have, and therefore they were able to create a business. So how do people get out of the working poor and into the middle class? Well, the only way they can do it, the only two ways they can do it in an unregulated economy, are number one, by having a set of skills, which typically are the consequence of heredity. Your father was a doctor, you become a doctor. Your father was a lawyer, you become a lawyer. Your father was a CPA, you become a, you know, whatever it may be. The family has enough money to educate you. There's a grounding in the knowledge. I mean, this is, again, we're back to Dickens' England, which is the direction that we're heading. Or, number two, laborers get together and say, we're not going to work unless you pay us a decent wage. Now, the problem with that is that if you've got, you know, 20 million people looking for jobs, and, you know, 100,000 of them say, we're not, you know, at Walmart employees, for example, say, you know, pay us a living wage or we're not going to work anymore. Walmart can simply say, okay, you're fired. There's, you know, there's actually 13 or 14 million people actually out of work, and a lot of people who are underemployed. The 23 million is a number that Mitt Romney likes to quote because it sounds so big. But in any case, somebody else will come and take your job. So the only way you can do that is to have a union. And a union, in order to be able to say, you must negotiate with us rather than simply fire us and hire replacement scab workers, a union requires the force of government to enforce that union's existence in that union contract. And that's what Ronald Reagan started taking apart. So we are quickly moving toward the natural state of laissez-faire capitalism, which is no middle class or a very, very small middle class. The doctors and lawyers, and that's it. The specialists, the shopkeepers, and everybody else is the working poor. That's the direction America is moving. And that's the direction Mitt Romney wants to take us. And Barack Obama, President Obama, has to stand up and say, I stand with labor unions. We're gonna change our trade laws so that offshoring jobs is no longer profitable. And by the way, the Democrats passed legislation to do this out of the House, and it was filibustered in the Senate, as I mentioned in the last half hour. Needs to say that and say it clearly. We're going to have a middle class in this country. Again.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But it's going to be a damn hard slog as long as the Republicans control the House of Representatives, which is another reason, and if God forbid Mitt Romney becomes president, another reason to get out there and get active.
Tom Hartman.
He is the most interesting man in the world.
Oh, really? Welcome back 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It is an amazing time. And we are seeing the fulfillment of a strategy that was put into place the day that President Obama was sworn into office. And I have found and now lost. Here it is, right here. The original story on this. One of the best summaries of this is, it's an old Daily Kos piece that was posted by Keep Him Honest back on June 8th of this year. The headline, Eric Cantor, Paul Ryan, and Kevin McCarthy plot to sabotage U.S. economy with Frank Luntz. And this is what happened. Frank Luntz met with Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Hensarling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren, Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, Bob Corker, and Newt Gingrich. They met in the caucus room restaurant, which is just, it was the backside of the building that Louise and I used to live in, down on the corner of 9th and D, Northwest, here in Washington, D.C., about 15 blocks, 10 blocks from where we're sitting right now and talking with you. They sat in that restaurant in a private room as the inaugural balls were going on. I was over in Union Station at the inaugural ball. James Taylor was singing. Joe Biden was dancing with his wife, Jill. And then President Obama came out and danced with Michelle. And it was just a fine old time. And we had no idea that 14 Republican leaders of Congress, Frank Luntz and Newt Gingrich, were meeting in the caucus room restaurant and planning to destroy the economy of the United States over the next 4 years so that Obama would be a one-term president, and in the hopes that they could turn Obama into Herbert Hoover. Their optimal dream was to have the Democratic Party and President Obama remembered by posterity at the way we remember Herbert Hoover, you know, who was president in 1929 when the stock market crashed and did nothing about it for 2.5 years, or nothing of great consequence. And as a result, Franklin Roosevelt came in and we had a revolution. The New Deal. And what they want to do is they want to completely undo the New Deal and take us back to the way it was during the robber baron era, when working people had no power whatsoever. Unions had, you couldn't form a union functionally. Employers, they killed union members. They want to take us back to a time when, you know, regulations? Oh! So how are they going to do this? How are they going to destroy the Obama presidency? By swearing an oath to each other, or basically agreeing that they would be the Taliban to Obama. The Taliban. Now, keep in mind, these are the guys who voted yes to the Bush-Cheney January 2008 stimulus pill. They voted yes to the Bush-Cheney bailout of Bill Stearns. They voted yes to the bailout of AIG. They voted yes to the September 2008 Bush-Cheney TARP. They voted yes to the October 2008 Bush-Cheney TARP. They were all in favor of, you know, they'd raised the debt ceiling. They'd voted for the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. They'd voted for all this budget-busting stuff. And then they got together and they said, now it's time for us to become the Taliban. Now, you think I'm exaggerating. Keep in mind, 700,000 jobs a month were being lost at that point. January 20th, 2009, 750,000 jobs were lost that month. After the meeting, in an interview with the National Journal, Congressman Pete Sessions, who was in that meeting, where they laid out a strategy which was executed here in the United States over the next 3 years to this day, with the exception of the 2 months and 1 day before Scott Brown was sworn in as a Republican from Massachusetts. During that 2 months and 1 day that Obama actually had a filibuster-proof Senate, he was actually able to get things done, like the stimulus. After that, not so much. Because of these guys. And Pete Sessions, who was there, said to the National Journal, Taliban insurgency. We understand perhaps a little bit more because of the Taliban. Insurgency is the way they went about. Now, why is he talking about the Taliban? Insurgency is the way they went about systematically understanding how to disrupt and change a person's entire process. Now, keep in mind, he's talking about the President of the United States. You think I'm exaggerating? Just keep listening. This is verbatim Congressman Pete Sessions, March 2009, to the National Journal. And these Taliban is an example of how you go about to change a person from their understanding to their operations, to their frontline message. And we need to understand that insurgency may be required when dealing with the other side, dealing with the Democrats, dealing with the administration. If these Democrats do not give us those options or opportunities, then we will become insurgency. I think insurgency is a mindset and an attitude that we're going to have to search for and find ways to get our message out and be prepared to see things for what they are rather than trying to do something about them. In other words, okay, everybody, look, the economy's falling off the edge of the earth. We're losing 700,000 jobs a month. This is the way it is. We're going to keep it this way for the next 4 years. We're going to throw America into a depression so we can blame it on Obama and the Democrats So for the next generation, just like Roosevelt, you know, the Republicans had nothing for a generation. For the next generation, the Democrats will have nothing. They put this thing into place, and as I said, I met Harry Reid weekend before last or 2 weeks ago in Las Vegas, and he made this comment. He's been Senate Majority Leader the same number of years as Lyndon Johnson was. He's had 387, as I recall, filibusters that he's had to deal with were good pieces of legislation that would have put people back to work, that would have rebuilt the infrastructure of this country, that would have solved the unemployment crisis, where those kinds of things were put forward and passed out of the House of Representatives under when Nancy Pelosi was running it, only to be filibustered in the U.S. Senate. And how many filibusters did Lyndon Johnson have in his 6 years? And keep in mind, that was a wild and crazy time. This was following Brown versus Board of Education. This was literally the 6 years following Brown v. Board. Forced busing, all this kind of stuff. The pill was coming out, psychedelics, everything. How many filibusters did Lyndon Johnson deal with? One. This was a strategy by this group of Republicans to destroy the United States. Bob Corker, John Ensign, Tom Coburn, John Kyle, Jim DeMint, Dan Lundgren, Pete Hoekstra, Jeb Henseling, Pete Sessions, Kevin McCarthy, Eric Cantor, and Paul Ryan.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you in Washington, D.C., and I'm very honored and pleased to have in the studio with me a very special guest, Dana Siegelman, the daughter of former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. Dana, great to see you again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Tell us, for listeners who may not know the story of Don Siegelman, your father, the former governor of Alabama, and also he was he held several different positions in that state. Did you know he was the Attorney General? I'm sorry?
Well, that's correct. He was actually one of the longest-running Democrats in the Southeast, which is one of the reasons we believe he was politically targeted. But he did hold all of the highest elected offices in Alabama, so Secretary of State, Attorney General, Lieutenant Governor, and then Governor.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And he, in 2002, was the election, right? Ran against Bob Riley. Won, went to bed thinking that he'd won, woke up discovering that a Republican district in the middle of the night had discovered 15,000, was it, votes?
It was about 7,000 votes in Baldwin County that had been switched just in the gubernatorial precinct. No other candidates had votes that were shifted, just votes shifted to Bob Riley, my dad's opponent,
right,
which is why the scholars say that this was obviously a fraudulent election. It's just simply impossible for something like that to happen.
And he started yelling about it, and they squashed him like a bug. I don't know how to say it beyond that. Tell us the story of what happened to your father.
So basically, I mean, you hear about election fraud a lot now, and Dad's case was one of the first where you had a contested election where, you know, it had been announced that he was the winner. Then in the middle of the night, the vote shifted and his opponent came forward the next morning claiming that he was the winner. So obviously Dad contested the results. What happened was, however, that the Attorney General at the time, Bill Pryor, said anyone who recounts these votes is going to prison. I mean, we'll throw you in prison if you try to recount these votes by hand.
Really?
That's correct.
Is he a Republican?
He is Republican, yes.
Yeah, okay.
It was actually his office which started to investigate Dad on the state level, which then Laura Canary turned into a federal investigation in 2005.
And Laura Canary is the husband of Bill Canary, who was the campaign manager for Bob Riley, the guy that your dad was running against, and was also Karl Rove's best friend from the good old days when Karl Rove used to live down in Alabama, right?
It's so obviously... They're so obviously connected in their ideology and their goals, which are very political.
Right.
You know, they're there to protect special interest, and whether it's the prosecutorial level or whether it's the attorney general or the governor's race, you know, it was basically a handful of Republican operatives that sought to take my father out of politics. So this AG blocked the recount of the votes, and my dad would have liked to take it to the court, which was the next level, except all the judges are Republicans, thanks to Karl Rove, who came in the 1990s, and due to the tort reform movement, he switched. He helped basically vet these
Republican judges
to be Republican. That's
amazing.
Correct.
By the way, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Dana Siegelman, the daughter of former governor, Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. The website is free-don.
I'm wearing it. I don't know if people can see it, but it's actually on the shirt.
There it is.
Because I'm wearing this. I wear this every day. It's so easy now to get dressed in the morning. what we have right now is a petition going to the president that I've started on behalf of my father and his pardon. I believe he should be fully pardoned. However, the president has the choice to commute the sentence as well, which means he wouldn't be able to practice law, wouldn't be able to vote, wouldn't be able to leave the country, but at least he wouldn't be in prison.
Right.
And at the same time, we want another investigation of the DOJ. I mean, we want to know, did this happen to other people? We believe it did. And if so, why were people politically targeted? And we do know because of the U.S. attorney scandal that 8 prosecutors, U.S. prosecutors, were fired for not targeting Democrats.
Now, my understanding of how this worked, and correct me if I have any of the details of this wrong, I'll try to do it very quickly, is that your father was in favor of the state of Alabama having a lottery that would help fund education, scholarships, and schools and things. And Ralph Reed and Jack, what's his name?
Abramoff,
thank you. And their buddies and Karl Rove were all very opposed to that because they were in it with the Indian casinos and they didn't want the competition. And your father had appointed a fellow to the position of hospital oversight board that the previous Republican governor had also appointed to that position.
The previous 3 governors appointed this person.
And this is an unpaid job.
Right, non-paying position.
That this guy got. And this guy had made a contribution to the organization, which your father did not run or have anything to do with. He just supported the goal of it. That was trying to get the lottery in the state to help education. Am I right so far? So then they came in and they said, because your father appointed this guy to this position, which is his job as a governor, mm-hmm. is to make these political appointments, and that position was open, and he appointed the same guy the 3 previous governors had, he was guilty of bribery.
Yeah,
and that's why he's in jail right now.
The real sick thing is that Richard Scrushy, who was the health executive that was reappointed to this non-paying board, not only had sat on the board for 12 years under 3 other governors and had resigned from the board, didn't want to sit on it anymore, he had actually contributed to those governors' races. So he had contributed directly to, actually held a fundraiser for Bob James, who preceded my father. So
A Republican.
So what you have is, you know, him not only not contributing to my father's campaign, my father was already elected as governor.
Right.
What he contributed to was this education lottery referendum campaign, which would have gotten free education for underprivileged kids in Alabama, which was a pet project of my father. So he didn't give my father any money. My father was never said to have benefited a penny. And yet he actually contributed to these other governors running for office who appointed him.
None of whom are in jail.
And when my dad did it, suddenly, you know, it's like, oh, we can't have this Fortune 500 company health executive supporting a Democrat. It's, you know, forbidden. Why is he doing this?
Right. And they could support Republicans all day long. That's just fine. We're talking about Dana Siegelman. Free-don.org is the website. Go there right now and check it out.
And please post it on Facebook and Twitter it and make sure your friends know what's happened in this country and have everyone, you know, sign it.
So Karl Rove's best friends. If Karl Rove's best friend was running the campaign against your dad.
But Karl Rove himself was involved. We have sworn testimony in front of the House Judiciary Committee, 150 pages of it, where Dana Jill Simpson, an operative of Karl Rove's, hired by Karl Rove and Bob Riley, my dad's running opponent, to spy on my father and collect evidence that would possibly throw him out of the race prior to this indictment. However, during the time of preceding the trial, she was privileged to phone calls where these people talked about, this is the judge that we have for the case, he's going to hang Don Siegelman, Karl Rove's promised the DOJ will pursue Siegelman, these are the girls we've got on the case, and then of course they meant Wow. Laura Canary, Bill Canary's wife, and Alice Martin.
Right. And Laura Canary was the federal prosecutor.
Right. But
and
this
the
is,
wife of the guy who's running the campaign of Bob Riley.
Right. And this is sworn testimony. Not only did they take her word for it, they pulled her phone records to make sure she actually did have conversations with the people.
So
that
if anybody should be in prison right now, it's Karl Rove.
Absolutely. And I would say, you know, the former governor, Bob Riley, and Canary, and both Canaries.
Yeah, I mean, there's a major conspiracy here to take a good man and put him in prison, and which is where he is sitting right now as we speak. Your father is in prison.
He is.
In a federal prison.
He is.
And if this standard of you appointed somebody who didn't even contribute to your campaign to a board that the governor is supposed to appoint somebody to, if this standard was held, President Obama would be in prison. Every president forever would be in prison for appointing ambassadors. And they're appointing, you know, I don't get
But started. Like I said, the sick part is Richard Scrooge did not want this seat on the health board. He had resigned. When my dad
he did it as a favor to your dad.
Absolutely. He said, look, incredible. You know, you need a Republican.
Yeah, yeah, we've got to wrap it up. Dana Siegelman, go to free-don.org now.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Once again, free-don.org. Dana, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you
Good
so
luck.
Much.
And give my best to your dad.
Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
Okay, back in 2003... when my progressive talk radio program was first nationally syndicated on Sirius Satellite Radio in about 24 stations around the country, we started out, one of the regular callers was a guy, Jeff in Denver. This is from page 199 of my book, Screwed. I start out by telling the story of activists who actually did something. And Jeff was calling, and he went out and basically got active in his local Democratic Party. I tell the story of Lupita in Oregon. Lupita Moore, the party chair of the Washington County Democrats, the Washington County Democratic Party, and the amazing stuff she did. And I tell a story about this guy named Roy Street, who used to call into the show starting around 2006, which is 6 years ago. He was calling into the show regularly and you know, as recently as a year ago, it seems. Roy, he would identify himself as Roy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. He had recently gotten involved in local politics, he said, in part, I'm reading from my book here, in part because he was, quote, inspired by that guy from Colorado who called your show a few years ago and got active. He was talking about Jeff. Because Jeff had called in and, you know, was kind of upset about things. And I said, well, why don't you get active in the Democratic Party? Or maybe it was his idea, I don't recall. But he did. And he was calling, giving us the blow-by-blows. And so Roy said, you know. So Roy was brimming with enthusiasm. This is what Roy wrote to me in an email. He said, New Mexico now has verifiable paper ballots for every election in the state. Some serious guys did some serious work. They created the parade, and the governor got out in front of it. Fortunately, now, among those serious guys was Roy. Fortunately, we had a Democratic governor, a democratically controlled roundhouse, because it pretty much went party-line vote. But it went down about 6 hours before the session closed. It's not perfect, but at least we've now got ballots we can look at and we can recount. Turned out, I wrote in the book, Roy was one of those serious guys. He'd shown up for Democratic Party meetings in the community. He said, now I'm a Democratic precinct vice chair. I'm the vice president of the County Democratic Club. Roy wrapped up his call with a message to our listeners. He said, the main reason, this was a phone call, I'm sorry, that we had transcribed. Sue Nethercutt had transcribed, not an email that he'd sent me. Roy wrapped up his call with a message to our listeners. He said, the main reason I called in is to say that when you get down and you feel like you've been kicked in the teeth, just keep on pitching. Get out there and just agitate. Get the word around the country, Tom. People, just get out there. Heck, it's fun. Roy was right. Roy has just passed away, October 23rd. The Democratic Party of New Mexico chairman, Javier Gonzalez, wrote, the Democratic Party of New Mexico is saddened to hear the sudden passing of longtime Sandoval County activist Roy Street. Roy was an active member of the Placidas community and was supportive of all Democratic candidates, both local and statewide. Roy's activism will not be forgotten. His work has benefited many Democratic candidates and organizations statewide, including our own party. And there's a thread about this over at on the message board, TomHartmann.com. You know, Roy helped bring verifiable paper ballots to New Mexico. And, Roy, we're going to miss you. It's really, really sad. But Roy would not want us to sit around and complain or whine or commiserate. He would want us to, as he said on the air, get out there and get active. Don't get down. Convert those, whatever those emotions may be, you know, frustration, upset, whatever it may be, convert it into action. Because when you do, not only do you change the world, not only do you change, and changing the world can begin at by running for sheriff, right? By running for dog catcher, by running for the local PTA or the school board. A butterfly flaps its wings in Brazil, and Hurricane Katrina emerges from it. I mean, the systems are so unstable, particularly political systems. You just never know what's going to be the thing that just takes it all out there. And it may well be you and your activism. And that was Roy's message to all of us, is get out there and get active. And we are 13 days out from an election that's going to decide a generation. A generation of political outcome here in the United States. I am not exaggerating. The next president is going to appoint at least two, and most likely three, and possibly even four members of the United States Supreme Court over the next 4 years. Right now we have a 5-4 majority of right-wing wackadoodles on the court, and that court has taken onto itself the power to make decisions that are way beyond the power that the Constitution gave it, to come up with, to create doctrines out of whole cloth. Whether it's coming up with a notion of three trimesters in Roe v. Wade, or whether it's coming up with the idea that money is not actually property, it's speech. And I, by the way, I mentioned Roe v. Wade. I support a woman's right to choose to have an abortion. But that said, Roe v. Wade was judicial activism. Let's just be honest about this. The Supreme Court created law. It should not have the right to do that. Now, I think, frankly, the legislature would have come along had it not been for the court. But the bottom line here, if you are supportive of Roe v. Wade, or if you are supportive of women having not just rights to an abortion if they get raped, for example. Here, this is clip number two. The man who would be senator, Mr. Murdoch, here he is.
Life is a gift from God, and I think even when life begins in that horrible situation of rape, that it is something that God intended to happen.
Right. God intended it to happen. So Scalia says that, you know, if abortion comes before the Supreme Court, you know, there's no reason why it should be legal, or states shouldn't have the ability to criminalize it. And not just that, birth control too. Let's revisit the case in Connecticut from the 60s.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Yeah, Griswold versus Connecticut. I think it was 1964. It was illegal for you to have a condom in your house if you were married. Let's go back to those days.
When it's on.
Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news, Tom Hartmann Program. In how Republicans are trying to steal the election news in Ohio, more than 2,300 voters in northern Ohio received a mailer from the Ottawa County Board of Elections giving them details about Election Day. Sounds like a good idea, right? Hey, here's some information about Election Day. The only problem is they gave the wrong day and they told people to vote in the wrong place. Right. And President Obama, by the way, won Ottawa County in 2008. So, of course, very narrowly. So this is a county the Republicans are looking at, and they're going, you know, if we can shave just 2 points, point and a half off this county, we can flip this county Republican. So let's send a letter out to everybody telling them that the election is a different day than November 6th and that the place where you vote is a different place than the place where you go to vote. Meanwhile, down in Florida, people are getting letters that look like they're official, absolutely official letters. Here's this bogus election letter, although they, if people looked at the postmark, they'd see they're coming from Washington State. Kathy Dent, Supervisor of Elections, is the name at the top. This is not from Kathy Dent. She actually is the Supervisor of Elections. She's very upset about this. Dear so-and-so, the Sarasota County Supervisor of Elections has received information. She's the Sarasota County Supervisor. Information from the Florida Division of Elections regarding your citizenship status, bringing into question your eligibility as a registered voter. Per Florida law, only U.S. citizens are allowed to register to vote. Section 97.041, Florida Statutes 2012. And it looks like a very legal document, right? In addition, registering to vote under fraudulent conditions or swearing a false oath are both third-degree felonies in Florida. See Section 104.011, Florida Statutes 2012. But it doesn't just stop there. If the information from the Florida Divisions of Elections is inaccurate, now, see, basically they're saying, you have been accused of a crime, you must prove you are not guilty. You must prove you are innocent. This isn't how due process works in the United States. But this is how the Republicans do it in Florida. Or nationwide, actually. If the information from the Florida Division of Elections is inaccurate regarding your citizenship status, keep in mind, this is a phony letter. This was not actually sent by the Supervisor of Elections. But it was sent into a county where they do not want Barack Obama to win. If the information from the Florida Divisions of Elections was inaccurate regarding your citizenship status or if your citizenship status has recently changed, please stop by our main office with any original, and that's in italics. In other words, we're not going to take a copy of your birth certificate. You got to bring the original. Original documentation that demonstrates U.S. citizenship. Do not mail these documents. You may want to call us prior to visiting our main office. Also, you may request an administrative hearing with the Supervisor of Elections to prove U.S. citizenship. You must complete the, and then it gets really weird. This is where you wonder if this is just, is this identity theft as well as election fraud? You must complete the attached voter eligibility form and return it to the Supervisor of Election Office within 15 days of receipt. Failure, and now this is where, this is all in bold type. Failure to submit this form within 15 days will result in the removal of your name from the voter registration rolls, and you will no longer be eligible to vote. A non-registered voter who casts a vote in the state of Florida may be subject to arrest, imprisonment, and other criminal sanctions. In other words, attached to this letter is something you have to fill out and send in. If you don't fill it out and send it in, or if you don't do it within 15 days, the election is 13 days from now, and you show up to vote, you go to jail. Sincerely, Kathy Dent, Sarasota County Supervisor. And again, it's not from Kathy Dent. Don't be calling her and yelling, because she did not write this. She is flipped out about it. What the hell is going on? Well, this is what's going on. In Ohio and in Florida, the Republicans are doing everything they can to scare people away from the polls. They're putting up giant billboards that say it is a felony to vote when you're not. Well, it just basically suggests if you do anything wrong when you vote, you sign the wrong paper, you show up at the wrong place. I mean, this is the implication people carry away from it. That it is possible. Here's the essential message. It is possible in the course of going to vote for you to make a mistake which could cause you to go to prison for 2 years. It is possible in the course of your going to vote that you might make a mistake that could cause you to go to prison for 2 years. And they're putting these billboards up in largely African-American neighborhoods in Ohio and Florida. And, you know, and Latino neighborhoods. These are constituencies that they know are pretty much not Republican. People who are going to vote for Obama. Why are they willing to do this lie, cheat, steal strategy? Why is so much money on the line? Why is so much at stake here? The answer is really simple. The Supreme Court. If the President of the United States did not appoint the Supreme Court, I don't think they'd care that much. I mean, they would be fighting, of course, but the Supreme Court has the power to mold the future of this country for 20, 30 years. I mean, these are lifetime appointments. You got people on the court in their 70s now who were appointed to the court in their 40s and 50s. I mean, John Roberts was, what, 51 when he was appointed? He was a young guy. He'll probably be there 30 years. Scalia's in his 70s. He was appointed. Wasn't he appointed by Reagan, Shano? Yeah, he was a Reagan appointee. Reagan's long dead. Scalia keeps on going, the Energizer Bunny. If Romney becomes president, long after he's long dead, his appointees will live on in the Supreme Court, remaking the law of the land, coming up with doctrine out of whole cloth, inventing things. Oh, you think that not just women, people should have, men and women should have the right to contraception? Used to be illegal in the United States. Connecticut had a law that said that birth control was illegal, period. It's against God's will, you know. If you're going to have sex, you're supposed to have babies. It's that simple. A married couple could not have a condom in their bedroom. The police could break in and take them to jail. They took it to court. It went all the way to the Supreme Court. Griswold versus Connecticut, 1964. 65. Thank you, Shane. It's always good to have a law school graduate hanging. Say what? Wikipedia. Oh, okay. It's always good to have somebody who knows how to Google, too. But it's always good to have a law school graduate in the studio with you. 1965, it went before the Supreme Court. Shall it be legal for men and women to own condoms in the state of Connecticut if they are married? And the Supreme Court said, yes, it should be legal. The state has overstepped its bounds. It's overstepped its power in criminalizing birth control. Now, Paul Ryan has signed on to, and Mitt Romney has supported, this personhood amendment that would make most forms of birth control pills illegal. And now you've got, you know, Mr. Murdoch out here running for the United States Senate saying, you know, God takes care of these things. If a rapist impregnates you, that's God's will. I guarantee you, if men could get pregnant, abortion would be a sacrament. This topic would not even be being discussed. Here's the longer version of Mr. Murdoch's tortured explanation of this.
You know, this is that issue that every candidate for federal or even state office faces, and I too certainly stand for life. I know there are some who disagree, and I respect their point of view, but I believe that life begins at conception. The only exception I have to have an abortion is in that case of the life of the mother. I struggled with it myself for a long time, but I came to realize life is that gift from God, and I think even when life begins in that horrible situation of rape, that it is something that God intended to happen.
Right. And, you know, some of these laws that have been proposed by these Republicans over the last couple of years, even in the case of the life of the mother, if you've got, you know, the mother is dying because of something related to the pregnancy, and you have to make a choice. Are we going to deliver this baby and kill mom, or are we going to abort the baby and let mom try to make another one? And the law would require you to deliver the baby and let mom die. Seriously. Welcome to the Republican Party.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So that's why they're fighting so hard, because the Supreme Court is at stake. And it's not just abortion. It's a whole variety of things. In particular, the rights of working people. Money.
And ain't that news.
There
ain't
we go.
That news.
Ain't that news? Yes, it is news. And Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service is here with the news brought to you by the efforts to free America's newest political prisoner, Don Siegelman. Sign the petition, read the whole story, sign the petition asking President Obama to pardon Don Siegelman at free-don.org. Free-don.org. Victoria Jones, welcome.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Hey, it's always nice to hear your voice and see your smiling face. So what's up today?
Well, the Obama campaign today has jumped on rape and abortion comments by Indiana Republican Senate candidate Richard Murdoch, things that he said yesterday, where he said, "I've struggled with it myself for a long time, but I came to realize that life is that gift from God, and even when life begins in that horrible situation of rape, that it is something that God intended to happen."
Right. God is guiding the rapists.
Exactly. Now, today, a reporter asked Murdoch if God wants pregnancy to result from rape. He said, now, I don't know whether he said more than this. What I've seen is, that's a call above my pay grade, but God controls the universe.
So God was responsible for 9/11?
I don't know if he was asked that question, but it does seem to be one of those fake questions.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, Democrats today have jumped on this issue. I think they're hoping that it will turn into a Todd Aitken situation. Mm. That, of course, Representative Todd Aitken, the Missouri Senate candidate, who talked about how in the event a woman is undergoing a legitimate rape, her body has a system to shut that whole thing down.
Right.
Nevertheless, it is proving problematic both for Senate Republicans and for Mitt Romney's campaign.
Well, my understanding, and tell me if this is true, that the only senator that Mitt Romney has actually cut a TV commercial endorsing out of all the Republicans who are running for the Senate this year, the only one is Mr. Murdoch.
This is correct, and this is exactly what Jen Psaki, the president's campaign spokeswoman, told reporters today, or at least the Obama campaign did. She made some points of her own. That is correct. He did, and it was released on Monday, interestingly, just the day before these comments were made. And he speaks directly to the camera and endorsed Richard Murdoch. It is the only Senate candidate he has endorsed. Now, yesterday, Mitt Romney's campaign issued a statement saying Governor Romney disagrees with Richard Murdoch and Mr. Murdoch's comments do not reflect Governor Romney's views. We disagree on the policy regarding exceptions for rape and incest, but still support him.
Wow.
And they have not requested that the ad be taken down.
They have not?
No, they have not.
Wow. They must feel fairly confident about Indiana. Or is this blowing up Murdoch's chances?
Well, it is making it more difficult for Murdoch, because everybody in this Senate race is got a similar position. Joe Donnelly, the Democrat, has a similar position to Murdoch, but of course he didn't say it.
Yeah. So the Democrat is opposed to all abortions, even in the case of rape?
Well, the Joe Democrat, I believe, does hold for some exemptions.
Right.
But not, I don't know what exemptions he holds for, but he does hold for some exemptions. I don't think he's quite as rigid as Murdoch, but he's on the way.
Which makes it much harder for them to use this as an issue to beat up Murdoch with.
Exactly, and that's exactly what John Cornyn has done, the senator who is the chairman of the National Republican Senatorial Committee, saying that Murdoch's position is no different from that of Representative Joe Donnelly, the Democratic candidate in this very tight contest, basically embracing Joe Donnelly, who I'm quite sure didn't want to be embraced at all. Right. And Cornyn said something interesting that I thought was something the Democrats could jump on. This election is about big ideas and the reality that our country is going in the wrong direction. If you support Obamacare, government bailouts, blah, blah. Once again, the implication being that rape and abortion is not a big idea.
Well, from the point of view of many men, particularly older men, it's, you know, who are extremely unlikely to get raped and cannot get pregnant, it's probably not a big deal.
Well,
he's speaking for himself.
It's part of a theme.
Yeah.
The Obama administration and the former Jay Carney, the press secretary, and the secretary of state shot back today over emails from the State Department that were released, that, or at least were leaked, or that have shown up in various outlets, CNN, Reuters, and CBS, that they knew immediately that the attack in Benghazi was the work of terrorists. Secretary of State Clinton saying that they don't tell the whole story, telling to reporters, Clinton said, the claim of responsibility is not in and of itself evidence, and she cautioned against cherry-picking one story here or one document there, saying it's critical to look at the totality of information. Also, Carney saying that the whole point of an intelligence community and what they do is to assess strands of information and make judgments. Also saying that whereas this terrorist organization claimed credit for the Benghazi attack, it later denied having done the attack.
Right. And this is just I'm just astounded that Daryl Issa and the Republicans and Mitt Romney, for that matter, are trying to turn the death of four Americans into a political stunt.
Well, Saxby Chambliss, the senator from Georgia, is now calling for more hearings.
Jeez. Okay, what else is going on in the world?
The other thing that is very interesting is that the Justice Department today sued Bank of America to collect $1 billion in damages over a home loan program known as the Hustle. Which gives you a clue.
Yes.
A venture that's become emblematic of the risk-fueled mortgage bubble. This done through Countrywide Financial during the crisis, 2007 to 2009.
Amazing. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, and brought to you by free-don.org. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman Program broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica radio stations all across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on Dish Network, DirecTV, and 200 cable systems via the Free Speech TV Network. Welcome back. In the studio with me, Alec McGinnis, the senior editor for The New Republic, a fine publication, and the website TNR.com. And, Alec, you guys have been doing some really, really extraordinary reporting on – first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks
for joining us. And you've been doing some extraordinary reporting on election – not voter fraud, election fraud, or the attempt to rig elections in advance. This even goes beyond the old, I don't, maybe it's an apocryphal Stalin quote, it doesn't matter who votes, it matters who counts the votes.
Right.
In this case, it matters who is allowed to vote.
Exactly.
So tell us about it.
Well, I spent a while out in Ohio a few weeks ago. Ohio is obviously where this whole thing may come down to. And it's really been the battleground all year for a whole bunch of fights over who's going to get to vote in November. We've heard a lot about some of these other laws in other states that have been struck down, laws that require people to have voter ID, photo ID at the polls. A lot of those laws were put on hold or struck down, and so I think a lot of people think that this isn't that big of an issue this year. Mm-hmm. Actually, in Ohio, which is going to matter more than any other state, there's been a lot of fights on sort of smaller, seemingly more minor things that actually could have a real impact, such as the fight over early voting. Early voting is a really big deal in Ohio. It's been going on there for the last 8 years, 6 years. It's a way to reduce lines on election day in the cities where often in the past you had long lines and a lot of Democrats, minority voters, were not able to vote.
People in 2000 and 2004 famously standing in the rain, I think,
exactly,
in the 2004 election for 10 hours.
Right, Cleveland, Columbus, not getting their votes counted.
Yeah.
And so they instituted early voting as a remedy for that. But there's been this nonstop fight over just how much early voting to allow. And this year in Ohio, the Republicans successfully have cut back on the early voting hours, not as much as they would have liked, but quite successfully. And so basically a lot of weekends that you would have been able to vote back in 2008 where the Democrats, which the Democrats used to great advantage,
right,
were not available to them this year. And so that's been a very big fight that I followed out there. There are other fights over where early voting locations. I was in Toledo, fifth biggest city in the state, where the Republican elections officials wanted to put the early voting location in a town 9 miles from Toledo that is 1/20th the size of Toledo and is entirely white, which would have obviously made it much tougher for the large minority population in Toledo to get to that location.
Right. Particularly people without cars.
Right.
We're talking with Alec McGillis, the senior editor of the New Republic, TNR.com. And just back to the early voting in general, first of all, Husted, is his first name John?
John, yes.
John Husted, the Secretary of State. He's the one who has been fighting this, the
right,
Republican Secretary of State. My recollection is that when finally the Supreme Court said, no, sorry, we're not going to, hear your appeal, you're going to have early voting, he said, okay, then we will do it with very limited hours, and we're going to stagger those hours from day to day so that if somebody votes in the morning one day and then goes back to their community and says, hey, I 10 o'clock this morning, I went out and voted. So their neighbors or their friends will say, oh, cool, I'll go out at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, and they're going to get there and the polls will be closed. Because how does this work?
Well, exactly. The Supreme Court did refuse to hear his appeal. This is just for the final weekend that was in question in this case, the final weekend before the election. The Republicans lost this appeal. But as a result, he just went ahead and set these quite narrow hours, more narrow than what they'd had.
It's like 8 to 2
ago
on Fridays and 2
right
to 6 on Saturday,
exactly,
or something
it's,
like that.
They're sort of odd hours.
Yeah.
And again, the other weekends that prior to the final weekend all throughout this month in October, where you were allowed to vote in 2008, you were not allowed to vote this time. Husted made sure that all weekends prior to the final weekend were closed to voting this time around.
So people cannot vote last weekend.
Exactly.
They cannot vote.
Exactly.
Well, next weekend.
Next weekend is the final.
Yeah,
so
it's the final one.
The big question really is whether the Obama campaign will have managed to get their people out on the weekdays instead of, since they were not able to rely on the weekends this year.
It's going to be a big challenge the plutocrats, the Republicans, by and large, they're appealing to people who have white-collar jobs. They can take a day off more easily, or half a day, or entepreneurs, or just simply rich people.
What you're looking at here is
if you're a bus driver,
right,
and you're trying to take your day off.
This whole election is really about turnout. If you look at the polls, what you see again and again is that Obama's ahead under registered voters, under likely voters, what the pollsters deem to be people who really will come to the polls. It's tied. So the whole question is whether Obama gets out those people who may or may not vote,
right.
And so any way that you make voting more convenient through early voting or what have you makes it more likely that you're going to get those people who are on the edge. And so any attempts for Republicans, it's very important to make it less convenient to vote, because it's the Democratic voters who are going to be, as a result, going to be less likely to vote.
Well, and this is nothing new.
Right.
This is what literacy tests were all about in the late 19th and early 20th century, post-Reconstruction. This is what the poll taxes were all about. This is what the restrictive voting hours, for that matter, were all about.
And I think it's become more dramatic now, though, because of the demographic split we're seeing now, where the Republicans have, despite the efforts of Karl Rove and others who wanted to build more of a Big Ten kind of party, have really failed to diversify themselves. So this is sort of the last election they can hope to win with a very, very white base and a white electorate. And they're going to be looking at, to win this year, they're going to need to push their share of the white vote above 60%. And it's going to be really become much harder in years down the line to try to do this. This is the last year they have a shot of doing this, basically winning with very, very little minority vote.
Right.
And one way to do that is to make sure that the minority vote on the other side is not too high.
And in fact, in 2000, I was reading today in the New York Times, and correct me if my recollection of the numbers are wrong, I was reading it on my flight in from Chicago this morning, that in 2000, 13% of the electorate was minority, and right now it's going to be about twice that, more or less 25%.
Yeah, I think actually it was a little bit earlier. It was 92 when Clinton first won, that it was about 13%.
92, okay, yeah. Thank you for that correction. But nonetheless, what's happened is
it's
that
doubled,
basically in a generation, we've seen this very significant demographic shift. And here's the thing. If they succeed in rigging these elections in a way that they can put Mitt Romney into office, then he puts a couple more Scalias on the Supreme Court, and then voting rights and law issues come before the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court can tighten down the screws in ways that'll make it even harder for minorities to vote in the future.
Well,
I mean,
this is
all about maintaining the plutocracy.
I'm sorry to say that I don't think they even need any more votes. John Roberts has made clear that in the next year they're going to be looking at the Voting Rights Act, which is how the feds are allowed to look at southern voting laws, and he seems intent on striking down that law or parts of that law, and he probably has the votes to do it now.
But it's, you know, Kennedy, Justice Kennedy is the swing vote. He's the fifth vote. He's the weak sister among the five, the five right wings. And he's, 74 years old,
right.
I believe, and not at the best of health. I mean, he's rather frail. Ginsburg is in real trouble, but she's not the swing vote. I mean, she's a reliable progressive vote. Mitt Romney would clearly, replace her.
Sure.
But it's like there's that possibility. I mean, well, I guess we'll have to see how this shakes out. We have just a little less than a minute left. We're talking with Alec McGillis, the senior editor at the New Republic. TNR.com is the website. What can people do?
I think people care about this they need to vote, but they also need to make sure they get everyone out to vote. It's just so basic. I mean, it's the one day of the year where you do have more power than the big guys because you have more numbers, and it's just so simple.
Right. Show up.
Right.
Get out there. Get active. Vote.
Right.
Especially if you're in Ohio. Okay. Alec McGillis. Thank you, Alec.
Thank you.
Great having you with us. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And check out the New Republic at TNR.com. A great publication. Find the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I was reading earlier from my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, the part about Roy Street, Roy from Rio Rancho, New Mexico, Roy from Placidas, and how he has moved into the light. And, sad for us, hopefully a bright thing for him. But without getting into the whole discussion about life and death, that very copy that I've been holding in my hand reading from to you, we are going to give away to the caller that Shane, in his infinite caprice, decides is going to receive a copy of the book. So one of you, and I'll autograph. In fact, I'll autograph it right now. There we go. With my red pen that I use to make notes. Okay, it's all set and ready to go. There it is. So, speaking of calls, let's pick up a few. Al in Denver, listening on AM 760. Hey, Al, what's up?
Well, Tom, I've listened to you for a little bit, not a lot, because I'm a conservative.
For the last day and a half since somebody gave you $20 to call in?
Nobody gave me $20 to call in.
Okay.
Okay, the first thing I want to tell you is I'm a 30-year military veteran, retired Army colonel, and I know what goes on in operations centers, okay? And for the President of the United States to pass off what he claimed happened in Benghazi is nothing but straight lies. And for Hillary Clinton to stand up there and say it, she
Al,
is a liar.
Al, for you to come on this program and huff and puff that you are an ex-military official and an ex-officer and you are horrified that all of the American people are not instantly told all of the raw and unredacted intelligence moment by moment, day by day, says to me that you are either a liar or an idiot. Your turn, sir.
Idiot. There was live video.
Which is it, Al? Is it that you are a liar or an idiot?
I am not a liar. And I'm not an idiot.
Then if you are former military, you should know that when people are dying on the ground and you've got real time, really serious crap going on in a foreign country and you have only half a clue about what's going on, that you don't put it on the friggin' evening news.
That's right, you don't. But you have
and you don't want to have somebody from the opposite party like Daryl friggin' ISIS saying, "Oh, this has got to be treason that this guy isn't telling us everything." You are trying to politicize something that is a tragedy, and you're trying to turn it into a political point. That is reprehensible. That is beneath you as a former colonel in the United States Army.
Hey, how about letting me talk for a second? There was a four-hour battle that went on. There was an air base within 30 minutes there. I've seen what happens on the ground, and I know what happens in operations centers, okay?
And you want the American people to know all of the raw intelligence moment by moment, hour by hour.
No, that's
Al,
not what I'm saying.
Al, let me just ask you a question. Ronald Reagan, during the Iranian hostage crisis, when Ronald Reagan was running against Jimmy Carter, During that year, Reagan was asked probably 100 times, would you comment on the Iranian hostage situation? And including when the helicopter went down, the failed rescue attempt. And every single time, without exception, Ronald Reagan said, "We are all Americans. I stand with the President of the United States. I am not questioning his judgment. The time to determine what happened, how it happened, who did it, is after this is all over. That time will come in the future. It is not now in the middle of a political campaign." He refused to politicize the Iranian hostage crisis. Are you telling me that Mitt Romney should become a political weasel and you're going to support him for that when Ronald Reagan refused to?
No, you know what? What I'm going to support is the fact that the President of the United States, not Jimmy Carter, this president is a liar.
So you're privy to the intelligence cables.
He blames sequestration.
So, Al, you are privy to the intelligence.
He signed the bill.
A caller to a talk radio show is calling up to tell me that he's privy. You're calling now to tell me that you saw the intelligence.
I never said I saw the intelligence.
Then how do you know that the president's lying?
Tom, why? Because he's lies about everything.
Oh, brilliant. Al, your logic is impeccable.
He lies about everything.
Did
he lie in the last debate about sequestration, blaming it on Congress? He signed the bill.
You don't think that the Republicans in Congress voted for sequestration?
Tom, he signed the bill.
Of course he did. And he did not say that he didn't sign the bill. He said that that was something that Congress passed. Yes, of course he said. Richard, you are changing the subject.
No legislation can become law without the president signing it.
And because the president, in your opinion, lies about everything, therefore he's lying about Benghazi. That's your logic. Okay, I got it, Al. That's brilliant. Brilliant. Dusk in Palm Springs, California. You got a minute to the break, Dusk. What's up?
Yeah, I want to talk about abortion and rape.
Yeah.
I'm amazed that women are not outraged by this. It's not about women's choice. It's about women's health and lives. When abortion is criminalized, it does not stop. Abortion continues on. It just makes it dangerous. Women die. Girls die. And children become orphaned because of this.
Yes.
We're not going to we're raped or whatever. If you make it illegal, we're going to do it anyway.
Yeah, no,
Roe v. Wade was passed, for Christ's sake.
I'm with you, Dusk. Thank you. I'm old enough to remember, you know, when I was a teenager and girls got DNCs if they had enough money and they had family connections and everybody knew, wink, wink, nod, nod, it was an abortion. And there was a young woman in the high school that I went to who one day just didn't show up any longer. It was either high school or junior high school. Frankly, my memory is a little foggy on that. It was either my last year of junior high school or my first year of high school. And she just stopped showing up. Why? Because she had died. Because she had had an abortion, got infected, and died. And in fact, Lewis Powell, the Supreme Court justice that Nixon put on the court, the guy who wrote the famous Powell memo, he later told the BBC he regretted. Well, let me tell you about this right after.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
He regretted his opposition to abortion rights because he had had a law clerk working for him, or a messenger working for him, whose girlfriend had bled out and died in an illegal abortion. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, brilliantly representing the 20th District of Florida, but also the chair of the Democratic National Committee, the DNC. Congresswoman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be with you again.
Thank you for joining us. I would like to play a clip. This is just the short version. It's 9 seconds of Mr. Murdoch, the Republican who is running to be the United States Senator from the great state of Indiana. Here he is.
Life is that gift from God, and I think even when life begins in that horrible situation of rape, that it is something that God intended to happen.
As a man, I try to stay generally away from abortion issues, but this has jumped the shark. I'm wondering your thoughts on this and how this is influencing the race.
You know, it's hard to find the words to express how disturbing those views are. I mean, to say that a pregnancy resulting from rape is a gift from God, is was intended by God, is just, I mean, it's emblematic of how embedded the extremism is in the Republican Party. Between Richard Murdoch's comments, between Todd Akin's comments, the Senate candidate in Missouri who said that there was something called legitimate rape, and that women can't get pregnant from when they are victims of it. And Mitt Romney, what's more appalling is that Mitt Romney, the only candidate in the country that he has done a TV ad for, is Richard Murdoch. He has a TV spot that began airing the day before Richard Murdoch said this, and he's been called on to pull his endorsement and pull the ad down, and he's refused. He said he's banned by Richard Murdoch. Other than having a spokesperson, sort of blandly say that he doesn't agree with Richard Murdoch's views on this, he still said he supports him.
Is my recollection correct, Congresswoman, that when during the Republican primaries, when Mitt Romney was asked if he would support a personhood amendment, which would basically codify into law Mr. Murdoch's perspective, that he said he did?
He did. He said he supports personhood amendments, and he embraced the Human Life Amendment. That's in their own platform that would ban all forms of abortion under any circumstances. And when asked whether he would be willing to sign a bill that was a total ban on abortion if it was put on his desk, if he were president, he said he'd be delighted to sign it. So that's Mitt Romney's extremism on women's health and a woman's right to make her own reproductive choices is really shocking. But, you know, the larger issue related to women is how extreme Mitt Romney is on so many issues important to women, whether it's the fact that he still won't say. I mean, why won't he say whether he would have signed the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act? I mean,
say because he wouldn't have signed it.
Well, I mean, that certainly has to be the reason. And women earn $431,000 less than men over their professional life because we only make 77 cents for every dollar a man makes for the same job. That's real money. It's money that can be to be invested in our economy, money that gives women who are the breadwinners in their households the ability to manage their family's finances, and money that Mitt Romney says, oh, it's perfectly fine. You know, it doesn't matter. That's why it's so important that women get out and make a decision to support Barack Obama, because it's such a clear choice.
Right. And this is a very much a choice election, and
this is a
huge big deal election, in part, in my mind anyway, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this, because we have, if my recollection is correct, four members of the Supreme Court who are over 73, who are over 74 or 75. And the next president, the next 4 years, are going to determine a generation of American law.
That's right. I'm the parent of three young children. And, you know, one of the main reasons I support Barack Obama is because the impact of voters electing Mitt Romney instead of Barack Obama would affect our children for decades and really for generations. And the Supreme Court is the perfect example. So just to give you an idea of the kind of justices that Mitt Romney might select, the person in charge of his judicial selection process is Robert Bork. Now, I'm sure your listeners are very familiar with who Robert Bork was, the only nominee for the Supreme Court in modern times to be rejected by the United States Senate,
right,
because he was so extreme.
Yeah, and I once had a list of the positions on which he was so extreme. I no longer have it in front of me, but it was pretty breathtaking. I guess he was candid, at least. but
it's just amazing that Mitt Romney would choose him to be the lead on the selection of judicial nominees.
Well, I think it says something.
We need to make sure that we have a president like Barack Obama who understands that equity, civil rights, and civil liberties. You just look at the voter suppression laws that have been passed around the country, and the fact that the courts have knocked down those limits to voting rights. You know, if Mitt Romney were president, things would go from bad to worse when it comes to the civil rights and civil liberties of Americans.
Yeah.
When it comes to making sure we have an economy that's rebuilt from the middle class out and not the top down, we can't go backwards. We've got to move forward.
Yep, absolutely. Very, very well said. Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the chair of the DNC, and, of course, a member of the United States House of Representatives in her own right, ably representing the 20th District of Florida. BarackObama.com, by the way, the Obama campaign website.
Yeah.
Congresswoman, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. My pleasure.
It's a pleasure having you on the program. Wow, there's a lot going on. Patty in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Patty, what's up? Patty, listening to KPOJ? No, I don't think she's there. Okay. William in Reston, Virginia. Hey, William, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, Tom, hi. Thank you very much. Very simply, follow the money. All right,
mm-hmm.
I'll just give you an example here. Romney wants to eliminate capital gains. If he would do so, that would mean $3 million more in his pocket every year for not having to pay those taxes.
Right.
Inheritance
his tax rate would go to zero.
Hello?
His tax rate would go to zero.
Inheritance tax. Think about that, all right? He wants to eliminate the inheritance tax. The Republicans call it death tax because it sounds bad. But inheritance tax, if he eliminated it, his five sons would not have to contribute to taxes to this country of $150 million.
Wow.
It's about money.
Yep.
All right? If those two are eliminated, it leads us very simply to financial royalty in this country. If we have financial royalty, it is the end of our government.
I'm with you. Well, it's the end of democracy as we know it. I mean,
exactly.
Our government
totally
will become a full-blown plutocracy or aristocracy or kleptocracy.
And it would be legal.
Yeah, yeah. And
that's
and I would say that we're halfway down that road already, which is one of the things that concerns me so much. Thank you very much, William, for the call. Kenny in Ray, Colorado. Hey, Kenny, what's on your mind?
Well, want to talk about that retired colonel right there that was on just a few minutes ago right there and his little rant.
Yeah.
I'm ex-military myself, although I was never an officer.
Mm.
Why didn't you ask him what his job was? He sounded to me like a supply colonel that was forced to retire.
Huh. You know, it would have been a good question. I figured, particularly after he pivoted from that topic to, oh, well, let's talk about sequestration, that this is a guy who's calling radio stations. He's working with a list. I said you were paid $20 to call in, and he says, no, I wasn't paid $20. You know, he's probably paid $50.
Sound like any lieutenant colonel I ever served with.
Yeah, there you go. I do not take his concerns or his complaints seriously. I think he's a crank caller. Kenny, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate
it. A lot of military officers out there who's got real good reputations.
Yes. Yes, I agree with you. Kenny, thanks for the call. Tim in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Just had, I got my cell phone laptop here, so I'm trying to get the sound. Can you hear me well?
You're kind of faint, but I can turn up my volume. So go ahead.
Okay, all right. I've been thinking a lot. I read a lot of Nate Silver because he's got a very good track record. He's a technician, a statistician. He's got
Who is?
And I just read something.
Oh, Nate Silver. Okay.
Oh, right, Nate Silver. And James Fowle just has an article that just came out off the Atlantic, and he's talking about the fact there's a really good chance that the Romney campaign is punking the mainstream media.
Right.
And making it, this whole thing you hear about Romney momentum is just a bunch of garbage.
Yeah.
Because Nate Silver is still holding Barack Obama's statistical chances of winning the election around 65% to 70%.
Right.
Now that doesn't mean he's ahead by that much.
Let me check Intrade here while we're talking, and I'll just tell you what the professional gamblers. Well, Obama's down to 57%. He was up, as high as 70% at one point. Romney's up to 42%. So that's not
good.
Well,
that's Intrade. Yeah, I read Intrade.
Yeah.
I'll take Nick Silver over Intrade.
Yeah. Well, I think the folks who are betting over at Intrade are taking into account things like voter suppression and all the criminal activity that's happening on the ground. And what Nate Silver is doing is he's just looking at the polls. And I don't think he's taking into account the voter suppression efforts. So, the ultimate test is going to be 13 days from now.
Right.
I'm just trying to
put on a point there. There's a lot of panicked people out there, and we just sort of have to hang tough.
Got it. Tim, hang on just a minute. Shane just blessed you with the autographed copy of Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class by me, autographed by me. I'm putting you on hold. He's on line three. Shane, tell Danielle. And say what? Oh, brought to you by, sent to you, shipped to you by Stamps.com. And we will send that out today. So stick around, Tim, and Danielle will get Louise will get your phone number, your address, and we'll send it out. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls, my thoughts, and the news of the day in just a moment.
Disorder from sirens night and day, from the files of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Dave in Inverness, Florida. Dave, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I tried to get through a long time ago, but this colonel kind of got to me. I'm an ex-military fighter pilot years ago,
mm-hmm.
Vietnam era. And I just want everybody to know this, and I'm not going to explain it because I could probably be thrown in the Leavenworth Fort, but I'm telling you, I had many top secret briefings in safes, many secret briefings, and I'm telling the American people, and that's why I knew before the Iraq War, that they're lying to the American people.
Mm-hmm.
Every time they were lying to the American people, and it really wasn't about any mission thing, it couldn't hurt anybody. Like we were flying a mission someplace, and I'm telling you the secrets that way. But I'm just telling you, so this colonel, I feel like the other guy who called in afterwards, he must have been in a supply colonel or something like that. But us, we're basically on the line, throwing ourselves at the ground at 400 miles an hour. And because I could carry 12 500 pound bombs, And I'm glad I didn't have to go to Vietnam. I didn't, the war was over with before I was out of training. But I'm just telling you, I'm tired of the lies.
So you think that this guy wasn't actually a colonel, or you're tired of the government lying to us?
I'm tired of the government lying, and this guy was an idiot because he must have heard some bigger lies.
All of right-wing talk radio is 24/7 hysterical about this. If President Obama, mark my words, I've made this prediction several times now. If President Obama is reelected, this is what they're going to try to impeach him about.
Sure.
This is they're going to say, and the word gate is going to get attached to the end of it. It's going to be, Benghazi gate. and if it hasn't already, and this is what they're going to try. You know, and Daryl Issa has tried. I mean, he tried Fast and Furious. That didn't work. He's had a series of these little, you know, let's try to take down the president things. And
yeah, I know, a felon from San Diego.
Right, right. Well, I'm not sure he was convicted of a felony. I think he pled to a misdemeanor or something like that. There was just questions about, you know, it's awful convenient that business burned down and he got the insurance money and all this strange stuff. But
well, Tom, I'm a big fan. I watch your program 3 to 4 hours a day. I used to watch C-SPAN, but now they're just, you know, I think they're just puppets for both parties, and so I don't watch C-SPAN, but I've watched C-SPAN since 1988, and I've been watching you here on Dish TV for 3 years.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much,
I love the work you do, and I'd like to get to know you. I consider you a friend.
Well, thank you, Dave. I appreciate that. That's very kind of you, and thank you for the call, and thank you for watching the show, and for calling in, and for your service to your country, to our country. Thank you very much, Dave. I appreciate it. Let's see here. Arthur in Malden, Massachusetts. Hey, Arthur, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. It's good to talk to you. I was listening to this guy who said he was a colonel. And, I just wanted to come to your rescue because I am myself.
Do I need rescuing?
Well, no. Actually, you handled it very well, I thought. But I wanted to give a name to the fallacy that he was using.
Okay.
I was in the U.S. Army for 9 years. I'm a non-commissioned officer, which mm-hmm. means, you know, I was on the enlisted side. But
but
I also am a student at University of Massachusetts, Boston. And I got out my textbook and looked up in this book called Discovering Arguments by Memmering and Palmer, and I found out that one of the fallacies that he was using was the overgeneralization.
Sure.
Now, overgeneralization is like when someone says men don't cry, for instance.
Right.
Because, you know, you're kind of classifying one person with a lot of people when you don't have, your problem is insufficient evidence.
Right. He's saying Obama lies about everything, and therefore he must have been lying about Benghazi.
Well, he did say that he was lying about one thing, but, you know, I don't know if he exactly proved that he had lied about even once.
Right.
But he was kind of shouting at the wind.
Yeah.
There's also ad hominem attack, basically, meaning to the person.
Sure.
Which means that, you know, he was attacking Obama, directing attacks at Obama instead of talking about his policies. He was
right.
Directing attacks at the man.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree, Arthur. Thank you for the call, and thanks we've had a number of military people now call in and say, hey, wait a minute, this guy was. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. Good to hear the Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, my old friend Armin, how you doing?
Hey, I'm glad you're back.
Thank you.
Tom?
Me too.
Tom?
Yes, sir.
Do you think possibly a better way that we could all serve the people as a whole in this country with this election coming up is say, you know, we all believe that there's a left out there, we all believe there's a right out there, and we all believe that the vast majority in our hearts are moderates. They're not fanaticals either from the left or from the right perspective, and that's one of the unique things about America. So when it comes to Mitt Romney, he changes so much, it's hard to say where he really stands. So you have to ask yourself, what would be the best example of what he really holds true as his principles, if you want to call them principles? And I've concluded logically, and I think unbiasedly, and I think other people would too if they're really open-minded about it and analyze and discern the facts and the information, and looks towards his religion and look towards the Mormon church, and I'm not trying to attack it or say it's a bad thing, but their system is unique. It's very secretive. It's all about men controlling women. Women have to submit themselves to the men.
Armin, that is true. That is true
well.
Of the religions of probably a third of the members of Congress.
Well, that doesn't make it right.
Yeah, no, I agree. But I don't think that we can just blame all this on Mormonism. So, anyhow, coming up tomorrow, more of the news of the day, your thoughts, my thoughts, and as we move toward the election time, we're gonna keep an eye on this Republican voter suppression efforts. This is really, really getting dirty. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there, get active. Go to pdamerica.org and sign up. Go to movetoamend.org and sign up. Tag You're It. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.